This episode of System Fix was recorded on Friday, the 25th of January. Kia ora and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain and I'm editor of New Zealand Doctor Rāte Aotearoa. System Fix takes a look at progress within the health sector restructuring proposed by the Simpson Report. Joining me are our regular panellists, Gabrielle Baker and Tim Tenbinsel. Kia ora, guys. I hope you've had a great summer break.
Yeah, kia ora, Barbara.
Kia ora, Barbara. Yes, thank you.
What's been happening with health sector changes since we were last here? Well, when I returned to the office at the beginning of the week, I wasn't sure what we would be talking about today. Certainly, there was not a lot of news coming out of the transition unit at the end of last year. Well, things picked up by Tuesday when our senior journalist, Martin Johnson, surprised us all and secured an interview with the Health Minister, Andrew Little. And if you're interested, you can hear that interview in a special episode of System Fix, which will be online by the time we've recorded this episode. Contrary to previous reports, there is actually no established timeline as yet for the rollout of the changes. The Minister says they're still working through analysis of the report and actually putting together the policy on what the future changes might look like. He did remind us that the Cabinet has signed off on the general direction of the proposals rather than any particular aspects of the report. And we're not expecting any crystallised decisions until the end of the first quarter. Part of the work over the next couple of months is to put together a plan of the sequence of how things will happen. Mr. Little says he wants the physical and structural changes to be done quickly so we can get to, as he quoted, the real hard yards of system and culture, so getting those in place. So we should expect some announcements near the beginning of the second quarter, end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter. And just reiterate, so no decisions being made on the implementation plans or timelines. The other issue that Martin raised was around the apparent lack of comprehensive consultation as yet. Still, he said the more formalised systematic approach to consultation will be unfolding
in February.
So that's good news. He says that in speeches he has given to date in the sector, he has promised to engage with the sector and to engage properly. In regard to the Māori Health Services, he's looking for a game changer when it comes to provision of those services. And he stated explicitly that he's looking beyond where the report went in terms of the role of the Māori Health Authority. So that's sounding a little bit more exciting. No, maybe not exciting, a bit more energy, I think. We obviously are aware that things have been happening over the summer break, particularly in the area of the Māori Health Authority, that there has been some informal discussions with iwi providers around how that might look. And so any comments on where we're at to date, guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's been quiet over summer, but I expect that February will be the big month. I guess it's sort of if something's got to go to Cabinet by the end of March, you know, even if it's just about the broad outlines, that work will have to be done in February. So it's all on now. I think the next 4 weeks will be quite pivotal to how the whole story rolls out. But we're not going to know a lot about it during that 4 weeks, I don't think. But it's an interesting way of doing it and establishing the broad parameters first and then filling in the details. It's probably better than trying to pin it all down in one go.
And the fact that he says he wants to go beyond what the report has proposed, particularly in the area of the Māori Health Authority, but also that he wants to properly engage, and he was quite strong on that point. So it will be interesting to see what form that engagement can take, because we've had pretty patchy with the last couple of reforms. Back in the 90s, we had extensive TV campaigns. And then with the primary care reforms in the noughties, it was more, let's just leave it to implement itself. I think that's going to be fascinating to see how they manage that, because they do like to manage things well. Gabrielle, your thoughts?
I watched that interview and I thought it was really interesting. And I was thinking myself over the summer break that I did my own timetable. Like, I thought to myself, they're going to want to have this standing up and new system operating before the next election. So they're really talking about something that's ready to start in some form completely at the beginning of 2023. So working backwards from that, my best guess is, before seeing the interview, was that the latest they could have quite full policy decisions is around May this year. So that allows for a legislative process to have legislation go through select committee and have that kind of scrutiny at the very end of this year, possibly in the beginning of 2022, and then an implementation process after that. So as I was working that out, I thought, while I'm not hearing very much, I know that there'll be public servants frantic trying to figure out, you know, how to best give advice and how to give advice that will lead to a kind of system change that's articulated in the system review and its principles and its aspirations and in line with what ministers have been talking about. So even though I haven't heard very much, wasn't that surprised, because I suspect there's a lot of working behind the scenes.
I think that's really interesting, Gabrielle, that, you know, I mean, just looking at the legislative timeline. So I think the key issue is what things require legislation. And clearly there's going to be quite a bit of the structural stuff that will require legislation, and what bits are kind of, I guess, not necessarily just filling in the details, but there are other sorts of changes that don't require legislation that may sort of either emerge over time or sort of have different sort of mechanisms. For example, some of the funding decisions and things like that. So I agree, the structural stuff, there's not a lot of time to get that sorted. And then the big issue there will be how the responsibilities or how the lines are drawn between the various, you know, entities that we're talking about, whether it's Māori Health Authority, Health New Zealand Ministry, DHBs, and whatever else is there sort of in the government sector.
I keep forgetting about Health NZ, actually, when I go through my mind about things that need to be done, and I keep forgetting, oh, yes, we're going to create a whole new agency in the middle. In light of the fact that we weren't sure what we were going to be talking about today, I asked you guys to come along with a topic that you were keen to cover off. And what we seem to have agreed on was the fascinating issue of power. So, Gabrielle, you mentioned this in relation to episode 2 when I was chatting with Ruth Jones and Jane Cartwright about issues relating to the proposed changes to the disability sector.
Yeah. Well, when I think about the question of power in the proposed changes, I'm thinking about who has the power to make decisions and how people, citizens, and I also think about Māori empowered to be decision makers in the system. So in listening to the disability focused podcast episode, one of the things that came up for me, or that I thought was really well articulated, was that there's not really a discussion about how power is shifted at all around disability. And there seems to be kind of this assumption that disability can just be dealt with in the same way as health. And what I heard really clearly was it couldn't be, and that by the people who you were talking to, and that more fundamental changes were needed. So that's when I was thinking about power in the context of that episode. For me, the thing I've been thinking about in context of power does sit with that Māori Health Authority, questions around that. The recommendation in the Health and Disability System Review was that it would become an independent departmental agency. And even in most of the alternative views we've seen, including the alternative view included in the report, that's not really questioned. So it's still seen as essentially part of the Crown. And that's not what I've heard Māori asking for. That's not what I've heard Māori pushing for. I've heard for something more fundamental in terms of a power shift away from ultimate responsibility sitting with a minister. Again, that those are the two kind of power things I've been thinking of post that podcast, but also in the new year.
With Andrew Little talking about the need for a game changer, that's a broad spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the idea of a Māori Health Authority that is not just another government agency, and you've got the power that goes with the funding moving into that agency. With iwi around the country, some are in a far better position than others.
Yeah.
And, you know, possibly if I was in Otahu, for instance, I might just want to say, don't want to have a bar of this, skip it, and we'll do our own thing.
Yeah. I think the question of how an agency of any kind, whether it's Crown or not, works regionally is essential to figure out. My understanding from iwi that I've spoken to is that a version of what you're talking about is the ideal. So I think it's possible for you to have an agency. This is stuff I think about all the time. So I possibly will give you a far too detailed answer. I think it's possible to have a type of agency that has a regional presences. And I'm not even going so far as to say in regional commissioning agencies, because I think that could be different depending on the region you're talking about.
I think the same should go for Health New Zealand. I think that's exactly what needs to happen for that too.
For Health New Zealand, it could be potentially like the regional RHAs, which all had a slightly different
culture. Oh, no, I think the regions would be smaller.
Right.
Well, should be, I think, to get local how people see their, you know, sort of localities. And that's why I can't see the point of retaining DHB's role in primary and community-based services.
The other thing that really stood out for me from the disability episode was, A, I admitted up front that I wasn't an area that I was particularly familiar with, but I thought it was very telling that ultimately both Jane and Ruth felt that quite often disability gets left to the last, and they felt that major advantage in this case, which is pretty grim in terms of the reform of the entire sector. Like, this, let's just leave this big bit at the end and then hope everyone forgets about us and leaves us alone. Tim, you're also interested in power, and in particularly who has it, again, like Gabrielle, and how thinking about power influences the ideas and the solutions that the transition unit develop.
I guess I should just come clean and say, well, you know, this is my job, really. I trained in political science, so I guess this is central to what you think about, that sort of training, thinking about public policy and through a lens of where power is. And I mean, the one thing that's really interesting when you look, you know, it applies to any sort of review, any sort of government produced or commissioned report, is that these things are not usually sort of brought to the surface about where the power lies and what sorts of changes need to be made to that. You know, you have to sort of dig and make inferences and all that sort of stuff. But really, I think there's a very clear view about where power should be in the review report. Whether that is what, you know, ends up happening with and the new minister is another matter. But it's very much a view that the power should lie in the state. And I think picking up on what Gabrielle's saying, you know, everything seems to be sort of tied to the crown or tied to formal government structures. We've had, I guess, a long period of, in the health sector in New Zealand, the state has much more power, at least in theory, to do stuff. If you compared ourselves to the US, for example, where, you know, look at Obamacare and the processes that happened there, it was just monumental effort required to shift the dial a couple of inches. You know, governments in the US don't have the sort of resources that New Zealand governments do. However, there's always a distinction between, you know, way things look on paper and the way things actually are. And what we know, and I think picking up on your point, Barbara, is that, you know, from previous reform efforts, governments can say they're going to do a lot of things and it all kind of starts to whittle away in implementation. And the reason for that is because there are other sources of power out there that are, you know, maybe not sort of acknowledged and that may be important to how the system operates. And, you know, the key one is the power of health professionals, maybe not to make changes, but to resist them. And we've seen that in both the 90s and in the 2000s quite powerfully. And the additional thing that we're just talking about, particularly with the Māori Health Authority, is in a sense creating or trying to create the space for a new type of power, which we haven't had in the system before. So that's an additional layer that I think is really interesting with this.
So, Gabrielle and Tim, have you seen an example within the system of this idea of a different sort of power for the Māori Health Authority where it's not necessarily sitting straight inside the system?
Well, I guess there's the whānau ora commissioning agencies. And when Tariana Turia, back in about 2014, was it, Gabrielle? Making that out of, you know, sort of saying these are not government agents, these are something else. Now, I'm not sure where that sits, and I haven't been following that story closely, but, you know, I think that's the idea I think that might be kicking around.
There are a few examples that are out there about how Māori health has been dealt with or Māori issues have been dealt with over time. For example, outside of health, there's Te Ohu Kaimoana, which looks at the way that fisheries allocations are dealt with. And so that's, it's a different model and it's a bit complicated to describe in, you know, under half an hour. And also you need to be a little bit more familiar with it than me, but it's been set up as a charitable entity of some kind, but it still does work that the Crown might previously have done, if that makes sense. There's also looking at co-management arrangements around natural resources that are out there post-treaty settlement kind of arrangements. And I've been particularly interested in one model, which is the model that's being used around Te Reo Māori and how the Crown and Māori work together within their spheres of responsibility. And there have been structures put in place around that. So there are other examples, and those examples, ones I'm looking at, are all ones that don't set up a Crown entity of some kind. But what I haven't seen is one that's dealing with such a comprehensive range of issues as potentially the Māori Health Authority would be dealing with. And certainly not as much direct Crown funding as we would be talking about if you were going to be truly resourcing it to do the job it needs to do. Resource is another source of power, right? Money is another source of power. And to do that job well requires a lot of money. So there will be an increased reluctance to hand over that power.
But it does seem like it's an opportunity to come up with a new structure that potentially it's not just going to be used in health. It can be used in other aspects where state currently has the power to actually move the power into the hands of Māori. If you want a game changer, and, you know, we could be dreaming up something completely new, but the time frame seems a little short.
Well, that was one of the things I picked up from the disability discussion too, was that one of the reasons they wouldn't mind, the people you talk to wouldn't mind being left kind of to the end, is that speed will lead us to have to negotiate every point and make a lot of compromises very quickly. Whereas with more time, we'll get a more elegant solution, I suppose.
And they were talking about the Enabling Good Lives solution, which is out there at the moment and slowly being rolled out around the country, is something they've obviously put a lot of work in. And now they'll be looking at doing the same thing again for something new. Every time we reinvent something, we lose something.
That's inevitable because you've got a limited stock of people, energy, attention. You know, you can't suddenly just increase that. So attention's going to move into the new areas. It's going to go from other areas. I think the big issue with any of the changes is a workforce, and I'm thinking here, you know, managerial workforce, that's going to be really, really crucial because there's a limited pool of capacity, there's a limited pool of expertise. In fact, there's not enough in, you know, sorts of skill sets that would be needed to put these changes on the ground. And inevitably, in some ways, it's going to be spread really thinly. We can't just sort of produce change managers or people with experience of how to build new institutions overnight.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. Power is obviously where it's at, and funding is right up there as well. I'm going to skip the regular quiz about the Simpson Report and instead ask you about what your predictions might be for the coming year.
When you asked me to think about predictions, I thought about it in two ways. One, which is my realization that COVID-19 has made it very hard for me to make predictions. And if you'd have asked me how things were going to go this time last year, I would have got it completely wrong. And also a reminder that that is still going to be a major issue for the health and disability system and for the country for the coming year. But I'm not prepared to make predictions in that area, just an acknowledgement. I'm predicting we're going to see a lot of positioning and people wanting to figure out how to either retain power or build power. And some of that positioning will be transparent and a lot of it will not. I just know as someone who's been through various iterations of health reform, not big reform, but, you know, iterations of reform, for example, in different health sector agencies trying to build up their power as a whole agency or individuals within that agency trying to build up their own kind of empire. So, and health professionals across the board are no different. So I kind of am predicting that we're going to see a bit of that. I'm hoping it's all geared towards a strong and good outcome, but my prediction doesn't go that far.
That's interesting because we are starting to see people moving from some of the primary care organisations. And I think when you've got an uncertain future, that's not surprising. I might just put in a little plug here for another product that we do, the Roster Te Rārangi, which comes out every fortnight. And that lists people moving around the health system. And I suspect it will be quite lengthy in this coming year. Tim?
Predictions. Well, if you're Sagittarius, it might be a good year, but watch out if you're Pisces. Apart from that, I think, well, it's either 21 or 22. I think that there will be some well overdue injection of quantum of funding. I guess it will come down to political strategy of whether that's best to do in 21 or 22 or in the first or the second year of a government's term, given that Grant Robertson is reasonably conservative in terms of doing this type of thing, or has shown himself to be that so far. But it might be that this is the year to do it. But, you know, that will take years, a few years to unfold. I think, you know, there's been talk about, you know, sort of dealing with the funding mechanisms in primary care as an early thing to do. So we might see some action on that. If we don't, it's because people will realise how tangled the knot is at the moment, and there's not going to be necessarily an elegant solution. So, but I think there will be some movement there. And I think picking up on what Gabrielle's talking about within the sector, turbulence, absolute turbulence, people moving around, lots of new spaces to be occupied. And yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of jockeying and positioning. I agree with that. And that's going to be across the board. That's going to be in government. And it's, you know, if Health New Zealand looks like it's on the cards, it's going to seem quite attractive to a lot of people out there in DHBs and in the ministry, at least initially. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to track where people go.
My prediction, or maybe I should call it my enduring hope, is more transparency in our system. And we've got a government that talks about transparency and accountability, and we have a health system that is struggling really hard in that whole area. And I would really, really like to see a vast improvement in accountability and transparency. For years at New Zealand Doctor, we've had a policy of attaching names to statements supplied by government agencies. So either the person who's quoted in the statement, or if they won't give a name, we use the name of the person who supplied the statement. We want to know what the people in the ministry are saying. And we want someone accountable for what they say down the track when we go back and say, 6 months ago, you said. Seems like a really simple thing to do. It has caused us problems time and time again when we come across people who are very reluctant to give a name to go with a quote. I do feel that time of reform and in time of COVID, transparency is so important. And if we had it entrenched in our systems earlier, then some of the suspicions that we've seen around COVID may not have happened.
It's just total risk aversion.
Yeah.
I mean, it was happening in the 2000s, definitely, but it really went up another notch in the 2010s, and I don't think this government's particularly any different. It's worry about what the opposition might get hold of.
What's interesting also, and I suppose I should have said in my predictions about the fact that we do have a government that's got such a strong majority, it does give them a bit of freedom to rock on. They haven't got the handbrake of a coalition partner, which is concerning. If they don't communicate well.
I think the messaging is going to be quite controlled because that's just what governments do now. Mm. And, you know, unless there's something to turn the tide back about the risk aversion, I don't see that improving.
I mean, one of the things I'm interested in, and I've got a piece that's coming out in the Policy Quarterly next edition. It's about transparency, about the Official Information Act, and specifically about an experience me and some colleagues had trying to get a bunch of information out of government agencies around disability.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a whole lot of tactics they use, but basically they don't hold enough. And so instead of admitting they don't have the key information the government needs to make decisions, and instead of admitting they wouldn't do this on an agency by agency basis, but effectively they're making a call about what's in the public interest, and they've decided disability data is not in the public interest. And it's kind of, they're not that explicit, but that's the impact of their...
Yeah.
I mean, that area just needs a... I don't know how you revisit it, because it's not in the interest of either of the big parties to do it.
No. Well, I mean, certainly one bit of writing isn't going to change the world, but it's just, it's all related to transparency. We don't really have the transparency we aspire to.
2021, eh? So we're all looking forward to the end of 2020 and now 2021. And it does feel like after a pretty slow Monday, the rest of the week has just kind of been firing off. So thank you so much, guys, and look forward to our next episode.
Thank you, Barbara. Bye-bye.
System Fix is brought to you by the Health Media, proud publishers of New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa, Pharmacy Today, Kaitiaki Rongo o Te Wā, and the Rosta Te Rārangi. Also, e-learning, providing education for primary care professionals. You can find out more about our publications at thehealthmedia.co.nz or subscribe to New Zealand Doctor at www.nzdoctor.co.nz. Thanks for listening. This is Barbara signing off. Until the next time.